Good afternoon, everybody. I hope you had a nice Labor Day weekend, getting back into the swing of things. A couple announcements, just class-wide announcements. This class is completely full. It is like full to the chair max. So if any of you are not officially enrolled in this class at this point, it's probably not going to happen. I'm very sorry to tell you that. I like to be as flexible as I can, but I just can't be any more flexible on this class. So there's actually one student who's maybe coming in. That's later section. Never mind. So if you're here, I'm assuming that you're enrolled. And as you can see, there's no free chairs. So it's going to be a full house all semester. But I think you guys should feel lucky because I think you could bid. I think you could sell your seat in this class for like maybe $200 to the section later. So for those of you who are entrepreneurial, I would not look down on that. All right, so welcome. Glad you're all here. It was anybody who wasn't here on Monday, does anybody need a syllabus? Okay, good. Just a couple reminders, I don't allow laptops in class or mobile devices, so I'll have you guys put those away. I got all your group preference emails. Thank you for sending those. If you still haven't done that, that's fine. You can send it in today. We'll be forming the groups later this week, and then you guys will find that out. So that's great. I usually can honor the requests. And let's see. I wanted to talk a little bit about the case. So the big skinny case is what we're doing in our next class. And if you guys are, you'll remember that you have to write an analysis for one of the five cases for the semester. You could do big skinny if you want to get a jump start on it. I would welcome that. The one exception is that I know a few of you took Liam's marketing strategy class last semester and also did that case. So if you, there's just a few of you, so I kept the case for the whole class. But if you did already do the case, please don't write it up because I don't think that's fair. So a case analysis, we're not going to spend time in class talking about the expectations because I put two things on the course website. One is instructions, and I think they're pretty detailed. And then the second is a rubric, which is what I'll have next to your paper as I'm grading it. So I think between the two of those, you guys should be able to see what I expect and be able to do the case on your own. If you look at those and you have questions about them, please let me know. I'm so appreciative to feedback from students, like when I mess up on the syllabus and have class on Labor Day. This is the beginning. You guys are going to be seeing these mistakes all semester. So I just appreciate the feedback. Are there any chairs here? Okay, so Ruby, are you enrolled in this class officially? Sorry, you are, okay. Is there anybody who's not officially in this section? Okay, then I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to ask you to leave just because it's full. If you can fit the next section into your schedule, it may work. There's still some chairs. Yeah, thank you.
Oh, that's fine.
Okay, so if you have questions on anything, please let me know. I really appreciate the feedback. But with the case instructions, if they're not clear or if you read them and you have questions, please let me know. I'm happy to answer them. And a lot of times they're like really glaring mistakes that I have made that I haven't seen, and you guys pick up on them, and you're so polite in your emails. So I'll just email the whole class and let you know what the answer is. So that's that. So if you want to do the case write-up for Big Skinny, turn it in before class. The rest of you who aren't doing the write-ups, need to answer some questions on the class forum, and please do that before midnight, or midnight before the class, so like Sunday night, 11:59, you should be hitting submit, okay? Because I want to look at those before we have class together, and that'll give me enough time to do it. Any questions about those things? Okay. I'm all hot inside because I didn't like that girl who had a I hate kicking people out, so I think that's going to go away, but... Okay, so today we're talking about just the digital age in general. We will talk about the digital consumer in the lectures following Big Skinny. And I was going to try to combine them for today, but it just doesn't work. So it's important that we give attention where it's deserved. And this is a really important topic, because what we're going to be talking about is how the internet, how mobile devices, how this constant connectivity that we have has changed marketing, and how it's changed the marketing landscape. So that's what we're going to talk about today. So I'd like to start with a story. Some of you guys may recognize this person. Maybe Tom, his name is. Maybe some of you don't. Tom is an entrepreneur, and he graduated from college in 1971, I believe it was. I have the details here. Yeah, he graduated from Brigham Young University with a degree in engineering, and he went on to work for a company that made that manufactured birth control and intrauterine devices. So he sort of hated his job, like many of us can relate to at one point in our lives or another. Hopefully you'll never have that feeling. But because of that, he found peace and solace in his hobby, right, which was making bread and baking. And so he, on the nights and weekends, would bake bread, and he realized this problem that there were no good at-home grinders to grind flour into the consistency that he needed. So he took apart a vacuum cleaner and hacked the engine and the motor to make a flour grinder that ground the flour into the consistency that he needed for his bread. And it worked really well. It was an affordable option, and it was better than anything out there on the market. So with this, he decided, well, this is, you know, I like this product. I bet other bakers will too. So he created a prototype blender. He called it a blender after moving from grinder. And he sold an at-home blender it was the best on the market, absolutely, quality-wise, and the price was great, but he just didn't have any traction. So for 7 years, he went on to kind of build and slowly, slowly, slowly sell blenders of his company. In 2006, he finally got enough capital to hire a marketing manager, a guy named George, who was a fellow BYU alum. And George would later joke that the job that he came from, he had a marketing budget that was larger than the entire revenue of the blender company. So you can kind of gives you an idea of the state of the company. But when George started, he was looking for ways to market these blenders. And they knew that the performance was superior to other products out there. But blenders aren't exactly the sexiest object in the world. So they were thinking about, okay, well, how can we get the word out about these blenders? And one day, George was walking around in the factory where they manufactured them and saw a big pile of sawdust, which was weird because they weren't doing any construction. So he kept investigating, and he found Tom in the back room sticking 2 2x2s of wood into the blender and seeing if they would blend. And sure enough, George had kind of an aha moment. He went out, and he bought $50 worth of supplies, glass marbles. I want to make sure I get it right. Glass marbles, golf balls, and a rake, and a lab coat for Tom. And he set him up, and he said, okay, Tom, I'm going to videotape you doing what you've been doing, which is this quality testing of the blender. And we're going to make a video. And this is the video of those marbles in 2006. Okay. So George put this video on YouTube on a hunch. And it worked. Within a week, he had 6 million views, 6 million people had watched that video. And the campaign as a whole, the Will It Blend campaign, have you guys seen this before? Now that Tom's in the coat, you recognize him, right? So some of you have seen this before. The campaign as a whole, which is basically Tom putting almost anything you can imagine into the blender and asking, will it blend, has gotten over 300 million views. And sales increased in the first 2 years, 700%. So I love this story because I think it captures a lot of what digital marketing did for businesses. It really leveled the playing field. A small business with a great product without any revenues or, you know, without enough revenues to make big waves in marketing can now put these goofy videos up that are actually amazing to watch, and they get shared on their own. And I think that idea that you can really make a name for yourself as a business now is really at the heart of what digital marketing is. And so I think it's a perfect story that kind of encapsulates a lot of what we're going to be talking about over the course of the semester. I think the other things they've blended are like, I mean, anything. They've done like a rake, a crowbar, the iPhone, the iWatch, and yes, all of it blends. It's amazing. So the internet has really, like I said, changed the playing field for marketing. And I think there's three themes that we're going to talk about today that I think really kind of are the foundations of how what these changes have meant. So the first is that the consumer is in charge, and we'll talk about each of these in more detail, but first, the consumer is in charge. Second, the content is currency. And thirdly, there's this new value or new ethic of publicness. So we'll talk about each of these in turn here. So the consumer is in charge. What does this mean? Well, of course, in traditional marketing, and it's hard to even think back to the days before the internet, but in traditional marketing, it was more of a broadcast system where a business would come up with their creative, their ads, their campaigns, and they would push them out through traditional media like television, radio, newspaper, print ads, those types of things. And the consumers were really held captive in a way, right? They couldn't, when you were watching TV, I mean, even before the remote control, nobody was changing channels, right? And like, even with the remote control, okay, you shift around a little, but you were still kind of captive. You had to watch some of the commercials. Now, with time, that has shifted. That sort of power, that pushing from the company to the consumer has now shifted from to a pull, where the consumers are only watching ads and only interacting with businesses if they want to. And this is, of course, because of things like, well, maybe it started with the remote control, then, of course, TiVo. But now, of course, we have, most of us can skip through commercials. We can put on ad browsers or ad blockers on our browsers. You can watch 8 hours of TV on Netflix and never see one commercial if you're binge watching. Not that I would know anything about that. But you can really, as a consumer, tune out everything if you want. And so what businesses have to do is now come up with a strategy that engages the consumer so that they're willing to kind of pull, as we say, it into their lives. So I just want to hear from a few of you, or from you guys, are there ads that you liked so much or campaigns that you were so interested in that you actively sought them out and watched them? Can you guys think of any? Yes, Caitlin?
During the
Girl Kids, just like random questions.
Oh, yeah, when they sit at the table. Yeah, those are cool. Those are cute. Definitely. That's a crowd favorite, I can tell. So as you can see, we're not tuning out all commercials as consumers. We're willing to watch the good ones, right? So businesses that understand that are doing well. And that's where that kind of leads to the next one, which is the content is currency, and we'll get to that in a second. The other thing that's really changed and why the consumer is in the driver's seat, so to speak, is because they can now have these conversations with brands and about brands publicly. So before social media, if you wanted to complain about something, you had to like look on the package for a 1-800 number, right? And nobody, I mean, maybe really disgruntled people with a lot of time on their hands were doing that, but most people weren't doing that. Now, if you have a problem with a brand, you can tweet them, and you usually expect a response pretty quickly, right? And so the consumer has become very opinionated, and they're very, and maybe that hasn't increased more or less, but what has increased is that they can now do this publicly. Right? So when a business does great, the consumers will let them know publicly. And so there's opportunities for businesses that are doing things right. And when a business isn't doing something right, there's also opportunity there for the consumers to let them know what they think. So an example that I thought you guys would appreciate, Russell Wilson, a fellow Badger, in the run-up to the Super Bowl of this year, the last Super Bowl, when the Seahawks lost to the Packers, of course they were disappointed. I mean, they couldn't see what was in the future for them. But so the next day, they lost on Sunday. The next day was Martin Luther King Day, and this is what the Seahawks tweeted out, right? This MLK Day hashtag saying, faith, you don't have to see the whole staircase just to take the first step, a great quote by Martin Luther King, but with this image of Russell Wilson crying. And the fans, and not fans alike, let them know exactly what they thought, which was that this was a pretty stupid idea. And that equating Martin Luther King lifetime struggle and assassination on the behalf of civil rights with a football game is a little bit trite. And one of my favorite tweets that came out after this, which isn't up here, but it was talked about how they were going to name at the Seahawks MLK Day now became Fire the Intern Day. So I don't think it's not only the intern's fault, whoever approved it, right? But so I think things like this are new, where a company can no longer screw up and sweep it under the rug, right? They screw up very publicly. And of course, the Seahawks took down the tweet pretty quickly and apologized, saying they didn't mean to offend anybody. But this is new. The customers complaining and kind of ganging up, rightfully so, on a company is something that is relatively new. So with this idea that the customer is in charge, comes this idea that content or what you put out there has to be good. It has to be as good as those commercials you guys are watching voluntarily, you know, taking your time to watch watch on your own. So the kind of idea around that is that content or the material that you put out is now currency. And what I mean by this is that for so long in marketing, you could buy attention, right? You could buy the attention of someone watching TV with a commercial. You could buy the attention of a newspaper reader with a big ad. You could buy the attention of someone listening to the radio with an ad on the radio. And with that media that you bought, it usually, well, at the foundation of all marketing campaigns, there's three types of media: paid, owned, and earned. And so paid, we'll talk about what this means kind of in the digital era, and then we'll talk about how content plays a role at the heart of all three of these. But so paid media is anything that the company pays for. So it can be an ad campaign. It can be it can also be an ad, right? Like maybe that when you're streaming Pandora and you hear an ad. It can be a search campaign, those types of things. But it's something that the company pays for deliberately to attract attention. Then there's owned media, which is what the company builds and invests in. So this is their website. This might be a social media presence. This might be their retail store. This might be, if you're Coke, this is a vending machine, right? This is any sort of physical or digital asset that they have and that they own. And then there's earned, which is brand-related conversations and actions around a brand. So this is when you're walking with a friend and you say, oh, I watched the greatest movie last night, you know, on Netflix, right? And you're talking about Netflix, you're talking about the movie. Or when someone says, oh, I like your jeans, where did you get them? Or someone says, I absolutely hate Charter because my internet is not working again for the third time this week. Those are all the conversations that are earned media. So it can be good and it can be bad. What the digital age has done is that it's exploded that and put that in front of everybody else, right? So these conversations used to be private for the most part. And now they can be private, of course, but they can also be public. So there's two opportunities there for business. Again, one, if people are having positive conversations, there's real opportunity for that. But two, businesses can now listen and say, okay, what is it that customers are saying about our brand, saying about our product, and how can we use that? Now, what's important to know and remember is that at the heart of all three of these media in the digital age, or in the age that we are now, really, is that content is at the heart of these. So if we look at a couple of examples of the media that they talk about, for example, if we look at paid, you know, paid media, you usually give, you know, that goes out to prospects. You're trying to get people into kind of your into your world, into your sales funnel. And those are things like display ads, sponsorships, classified ads, product placement, social media ads, mobile ads, or SEO, right? So those are examples of paid media. Then for owned media, we have things like a website, a blog, support forums, podcasts, email, text messaging, online events, sales promotion, virtual world, online games, gifting like gift cards, branded mobile apps, QR codes, location-based marketing, your presence on social media, or SEO, the way that you've built your site for search engine optimization that's organic, not paid. That's owned media, and that's something that typically businesses invest in to direct towards their already existing customers. So they move from prospects into the, you know, they try to get the prospects into the owned media to become customers. And then the earned, of course, is from is for fans and detractors. And this is things like digital coverage from traditional media. So if you, you know, the news story does a, if the news does a story on a viral video or something like that, viral marketing, wikis, ratings and reviews, social recommendations, email, social site discussions, community discussions, widgets, social apps, location-based services, or collaborative content. This is also, of course, conversations on social media between customers. So what's important to remember is that the heart of all of these is the content, right? Because the customer is in charge and they don't have to pay attention, if you don't put out content in any three of the, well, in, especially in paid and owned, people aren't going to pay attention. If you don't put out content that's either helpful, engaging, or entertaining, you're going to lose them completely. And really good content is something that you can spark conversations with and earn and buy some earned media, right? Earned media you can't actually buy. You can't control that, but you can create content that will get you in front of your customers and fans. So increasingly, we see a shift from content that is promotional or talking about the benefits and features of a product to content that just helps a customer or entertains a customer or inspires a customer. And that's what the best businesses are doing. We'll talk about some specific examples as we go on. Okay, and the third sort of foundational change that shapes the way that marketing is today is this new value of what I call publicness and the, kind of the tension between publicness and privacy. So the term publicness, we'll start with that because that's a made-up term or a new term, we'll say. I didn't make it up, but the author Jeff Jarvis, who writes a book called Public Parts, talks of, and he's a really good thinker about privacy and publicness, but he talks about publicness as basically what we do when we share online, right? So when we're living our lives online, sharing photos, sharing statuses, liking things, sharing news articles, all of that is sort of publicness, blogging, basically sharing online. So there's this tension, right? And I think we hear a lot about this these days between publicness and privacy. So let's look at both sides of kind of the debate. I think we live in a time where almost anything that can happen is shared online. And there are people who are really concerned about that, the privacy advocates. And these are people who say things like, oh, too many people are oversharing online. Or we have to be really careful to keep our data safe. Or companies know way too much about us. Google knows every, you know, our every move. And while there's certainly some truth to all of those things, right, I think that drowns out the, that kind of dominates the debate so that we forget about the benefits of publicness. But people who are really concerned about privacy are the people who might use the search engine DuckDuckGo, which is a Google alternative that you guys may or may not have heard of. It doesn't track you. So while Google is constantly tracking everything that you do and knows way more about you than you realize, DuckDuckGo doesn't track anything. So this is a new search engine with millions of users who are concerned about the tracking. And this idea of privacy and the value of privacy is also cultural. In Germany, for example, they have legislated that German citizens have the right to pixelate their houses on Google Street View because they think to show what the front of your house looks like is an invasion of their privacy, right? So here's one, here's another example. Which is interesting, very different from here. I think people here in the United States just kind of accept that that's what it's like. Nobody's really calling arms to that. So on one side, there's people who are concerned about privacy, and certainly there's some validity to that. But on the other side, which I think often gets a bad rep, is this idea of publicness. So before I get into some of the details, I want to hear from you guys, what's the craziest thing you've seen shared online? Either that you shared or like you just saw online or saw a friend share. And you were like, whoa, too much, too much. Yeah?
I would say like you see people from high school that try to like because they want attention. People do it because they see it and they think it's normal.
Non-model half nudity, basically. Gotcha. Yeah, Megan?
I'd say the majority of what Miley Cyrus posts.
Okay, so Miley Cyrus is the poster child sort of for oversharing, right? Anybody else? Meredith?
I don't mean to be like a Debbie Downer or anything, but the whole thing with the newscaster, that was just like all over the internet recently. It was obviously a lot.
When they were killed during the broadcast? Yeah, that was incredible, right? I mean, that was really intense. A lot of the things we see in the news are really intense, and we see really intense views of them because of everybody having a camera in their pocket. Anything else? Yeah, Emily.
My aunt posted her status that my cousins were engaged before they told all their friends.
Oh, so the worst. That's the worst. I can understand that. Anything else? Others? Yeah, Mimi? Right. Yes. Yes. I can agree with that, for sure. Yeah. Sonia.
I had a friend that posted that, like, to her family that her brother was in jail.
Oh.
It was a Facebook post.
That's someone who needs to learn about the messenger part of Facebook, yeah. Right? That's funny. Yeah. Jordan.
There was a girl from my high school who's like mugshot was
posted. Oh wow. That's really sad. So these are certainly things that perhaps cross the boundary of what you would feel comfortable sharing. But it's amazing what people share, right? So, and in fact, we just passed this huge kind of sharing milestone in the world. On August 24th, so I think that was two Mondays ago, Facebook announced that 1 billion people had logged into Facebook that day. And when you think about that, that's 1 in 7 people on the planet Earth logged into Facebook on Monday. So not all of those people were sharing. Most of those people were creeping. But you can think about how big a part of our lives are. Even if we're not posting about our jailed family members, we're kind of like gawking when other people do, right? So there's this new publicness that we live with and that we kind of have to make sense with. So one thing that this book that I mentioned, Public Parts, talks about is the different things people have shared. So one guy, for example, Brian Stelter, he was a young New York Times reporter who wanted to lose like 50 pounds. So he decided to go on what he called the Twitter diet, and he tweeted out every single thing he ate. And at first, he said that it was like pretty hard because he would go on these late night binges and then be too embarrassed to post about them. But because he made this public promise, he would be like at like 3 a.m. like, I just had a whole pizza or whatever, you know. But what amazed him, because he writes about this since he was a journalist, is like how supportive the community was and how supportive the public was. They'd be like, it's cool, like everybody does it, shake it off. Tomorrow's a new day. And it worked for him. He lost the 50 pounds and he would post these kind of status updates. Eventually, he got so into it that he bought a Wi-Fi enabled scale so that every time he stepped on the scale, it tweeted out his weight. Right? Isn't that horrifying? Right? I mean, I can't imagine. That's like the worst practical joke you could play on a roommate, I think, is putting that in your bathroom. So there's that sort of sharing, right? Now, there's also people who, and maybe this is more familiar to you guys than others, but who love to talk about what they buy, right? So when I was a kid and would go back to school shopping, like, I remember doing these fashion shows at my house for my parents. So people have now taken that to the internet, which is no surprise, in these hauls. And I'm sure that many of you are aware of haul videos, which is where basically, and I usually see women, although there might be men doing it too, buy a bunch of stuff and then they make a video and show everybody. And this has a tremendous amount of traction. According to Google, in 2014, haul videos were watched 1.1 billion times on YouTube. And they see a spike in it almost every year between Thanksgiving and Christmas, right? Like during the holiday season, they see a spike in these haul videos. So just as an example of one, and in the back-to-school spirit, I wanted to just show you one that I found that you might be able to relate to in some ways.
Anywhere?
Well, we'll stop there. Which I actually don't know if you can relate at all, other than back to school, right? We're here in school. But so I kind of, you know, I want to kind of mock this woman, but she does an amazing amount of traffic on these videos. And actually, she's quite a brilliant marketer. Her spray tan is, of course, a promoted post. Whoever is sponsoring her spray tan, she's making money from that. Her tattoo, I went on to watch a little bit more of the video. Her tattoos are temporary tattoos that she designed herself and is selling. And then she goes on to hold up all of her purchases. So, you know, the idea that you can share what you just bought, which is, I always thought was only interesting to my mom, is now interesting to billions of viewers. So there's this idea that we're sharing more and more online, and whether or not people, you know, I think there will always be this debate about whether or not it's good for us, because there is definitely a need to protect information and protect the information that we give and make sure it's used in the right ways. And that's an important discussion to have. But I think what often gets missed is this idea that there are some values to publicness that we might be overlooking if we focus too much on just the kind of what scares us about publicness. And so I really like this idea of what if we turn the conversation, what if we flip the conversation and say, instead of what's wrong with being public, what we ask, what is great about being living in public? And again, this book, Jeff Jarvis, Public Parts, I highly recommend. I thought it was great. It really changed the way I think about publicness, and I read it last semester, so you guys get to benefit from that. So a couple of the benefits that he talks about, the value of publicness, here they are. I want to kind of go through them quickly and talk about them in a business context, but you can also probably think about them in a personal context. So the first, builds relationships. You know, with customers, businesses can now have these one-on-one conversations, one-on-one relationships. Disarms strangers. You know, what is a stranger if you can kind of find out a lot about information about someone online? I didn't want to say stalk, but hey, if you're going out for a business meeting, let's say, you can look at someone's LinkedIn profile, know a lot more about them, kind of disarms the notion of stranger. Also, I think projects like Humans of New York, I don't know if you guys are familiar with that on Facebook, that also does a great job of disarming strangers. You know, he just came back from a trip to Iraq, and he said, you know, what the Iraqis might feel like strangers to us, but after you see some of these amazing pictures and hear their stories, kind of changes the notion of strangers. The third is that it enables collaboration. Businesses can now put out a product and ask people what they think about it. They can ask for feedback, they can ask for what they did like, what they didn't like, and they can tweak the product as they go. That's really an amazing opportunity. Unleashing the wisdom and generosity of the crowd. Just like our pizza binger got support at 3 a.m. from people saying it's all right, just starting in tomorrow, all of us can relate to that in some way. Maybe you asked your friends for a recommendation or about a product or something, or got support online. Same for businesses, right? You can think about customers asking these questions online, and business can listen in. It diffuses the myth of perfection. So companies blunder and they get caught, and they get caught a lot more publicly now than they used to. But what I think this does is two things. One, it really makes us realize that companies are going to make mistakes. They're not perfect. But two, that they have the chance to make it right. And so I think while people are expecting a lot more from companies now than they used to in terms of ethical behavior and transparency, they're also willing to give them kind of a second chance because we realize mistakes can be made. Neutralizing stigmas. I think this one especially, we're living in such an amazing time of progress and freedoms for certain groups of people. And if you really think about the great strides that America has made in the last year in civil rights for gays and lesbians and transgender people and the right to marry, I think a lot of this stems from living publicly, people who were in relationships and weren't afraid about, you know, gay people who were in a relationship and lived publicly and weren't afraid about that. And that really reduces stigma because suddenly we all see things a lot more. And those of you who've taken consumer behavior, you know that the more you see something like that, the less stigmatizing, the less it becomes strange. So I think a lot of that, we're seeing a lot of benefit for that in the progress of civil rights. Grants immortality or credit. So the author, Jeff Jarvis, talks about how we all secretly want to be famous, which may or may not be true. But you can be a little bit famous online, right? But you can get credit for doing something good. And I think for businesses, this is important. They do get credit when they do things right. organizing us. If we look at the Arab Spring a couple years ago, those were literally revolutions led on Twitter. So when the governments in parts of the Middle East and Northern Africa were trying to shut down radio communication, telecommunications, newspapers, and dominate the news, they couldn't shut down the internet and Twitter. And so governments were overthrown using Twitter, which is just an amazing thing. And finally, protects us. In that same vein, well, from a business standpoint, I think there's a lot of protection in living publicly. So if there's a product that is harmful for somebody and they tweet, you know, they put that out there publicly and they start to hear other stories, that protects other consumers. It also protects a business from, you know, they're allowed to kind of, they see early on that there might be a problem there, have the chance to fix it. I think on a social level, this is really, we're seeing this play out in, now that everybody carries a video camera in their pocket, you know, we see this play out with the with police brutality and people, you know, think of the countless number of innocent black men who've been killed by the police that would have 5 years ago just been closed cases. Now people are videotaping this on their cell phones and it shows up. And so there's really drawing attention to some of the issues that we face as a culture, and I think that's really exciting. Okay, so given these three shifts, one, that the consumer is in charge, two, that content, really good content, can buy attention, so content is currency, and then three, this value of publicness, you know, the question is then, okay, well, what are good marketers doing to take advantage of this? What are good marketers doing that works now in this sort of environment? So I want to just take a couple minutes and have you guys, maybe with a partner next to you, think about what we just talked about in the lecture. Think about the reading that you did, four ways to make an impact with digital marketing, and just talk about maybe one or two things you've seen that you think is working well in this environment, and then we'll come, you know, take a few minutes to do that, and then we'll come back together as a large group and share what you thought. Okay, so did anybody, thanks for participating and talking to your partner. Maybe you met a new neighbor. So did anybody have one that they think is really interesting, or did their neighbor bring up one that they thought was really interesting that they'd share with us? All right, so we'll talk kind of about some broader themes. You guys brought up great ones, perfect examples. So we'll kind of talk about what the article we read from David Edelman, Four Ways to Get More Value from Digital Marketing. We'll talk a little bit about that. We're going to then talk about growth hacking as marketing, which is kind of a new theme, I guess, that's a way of thinking that's arising in the tech world out in Silicon Valley, and then we'll wrap it up for today. So the article that you guys read talks about four ways of getting value from digital marketing. And Edelman talks about creating an integrated experience, inspiring customers to share your content, adopting a publisher's ethos, and using insight to inspire action. So we'll go through these one by one. I'll give you guys an example and talk a little bit about how I see them as connecting to the other things we've talked about. So the first, this idea of creating an integrated experience or creating a seamless brand experience. Companies now exist in so many different places. They exist as a website online. They exist as a retail store. They exist as, you know, a presence on social media. They may exist as an Instagram account, right? And so there are all of these different places that companies have to put out a presence. And what's really important is that they integrate that experience, and so that it's seamless throughout. So people who go to Target, to the retail store, expect the same kind of feeling that they would get if they looked on the website, and expect that same feeling if they had to call Target for something, right? So creating the seamless experience so that people are more willing to share about the experience and can expect the same thing. So an example, I think, that online retailers really have to do well is create that experience, because they're online, of what we used to know as retail, which is that you would go into a store, look around, try things on, and then buy them and take them home. Well, now online retailers, are kind of be creative in the ways that they come up with how you can do that. So one example I really like is ModCloth. It's an online retailer. You can kind of see the tone of their store here. But what's really interesting is they have videos of real women wearing the clothes, and what you probably can't read is, like, they have this woman's measurements here so that a woman, a shopper could find a person who kind of matches their body type and look at them and see how the clothes look on them, on a person that like them. Then they also have this whole section, they call it a style gallery, where users take pictures of themselves in the clothes and post it for other people to see. So if the kind of model person isn't good, you know, isn't real enough for you, you can look and see, are there people who bought that skirt who might look, you know, more real? And I think this is a really great way to replicate, you know, as best as they can, the idea of trying something on or making sure it fits or see how it fits. Because you can't try things on until you get them home. But of course, with another important part of the digital retail experience is the post-purchase, which is you've bought it and then it arrives at your house, and the returning experience. And so we see that with so many businesses, that part of this integrated brand experience is making for easy returns, right? We see that with Zappos, who has free shipping both ways. We see that with Amazon, that makes it really easy to return things. Any business that's serious about online retail and competing will make returns just as easy as buying. So the idea that inspiring customers, Edelman talks about this, and this goes along with the idea that content is currency, right? So businesses aren't investing money to create commercials that talk about the benefits of their products anymore. Instead, they're creating commercials that draw people in. So this is one of my favorite ones of recent. We'll watch it. It's from Toyota. So that was a Super Bowl commercial. They actually released it before the Super Bowl, and it probably got just as much viewers as it would have if it was released during the Super Bowl, and then got the other traction from people tweeting out pictures of your dad, because like Super Bowl Sunday with your dad is in some houses like the annual event, right? I mean, it's just awesome. And so this is such a smart campaign because it's something we want to watch, something we're happy to watch, and it's about dads and it's not about cars, although really, you know, Toyota's trying to position themselves as a family car, and so it's really a great move in a lot of ways. And we're happy to watch it as consumers because it's funny, it makes us laugh, it inspires us, it makes us feel good. So coming up with content like that, that people are, that makes them inspired or makes them entertained or makes them laugh or that they're willing to share is a really important move that we're seeing a lot of businesses make. The third thing Edelman talks about is adopting a publisher's ethos, which is this idea that you should always be putting out content. And because content is currency, the more you put out, the better chance you have of it maybe going viral or maybe getting some attention. And Coca-Cola knows this very well. They, within the last 2 years, I think, changed their homepage to basically a magazine-type website about happiness. They have articles and videos about happiness, about sustainability, about innovation, about history, about things that people are actually interested in reading about. And it's nothing about Coke. I mean, yes, it's branded Coke. You can see that. And there's, you know, stories about Coke here and there. But it's mostly about happiness and the things Coke is doing to promote happiness. Again, a really great idea about putting out content that people are interested in coming and looking at themselves without having the business have to push it towards them. And finally, this idea that he talks about, which I think is really important, we're going to talk about it all semester, but which is basically, he calls it using insight to drive action. And this is, you know, using the data that you have available to you to make decisions. I'll give you an example from my own working life. I used to work at DoIt here on campus on their communications team, and every 2 weeks they send a tech newsletter. It's called Tech News. And they send one copy to faculty and staff and one copy to students. And after the first year I was there, they changed the design. And then the next year, we wanted to look at which design of the newsletter did better. So we redesigned it to make it a little bit more modern, make it a little bit more mobile friendly. And we thought it was a much better design. We thought it would do much better. So what we did after the 2 years is we looked into Google Analytics and looked at click-throughs, which is basically people who opened the newsletter in their email and clicked through one of the articles to read the newsletter. And this is what we found. So on this chart, this is actually a screenshot from Google Analytics. And you know, don't worry about the numbers or details, but just the overall idea. So in 2013, those are the orange spikes. So here's our back-to-school letter. That one always does pretty well because everybody's still really eager and not overloaded by work. They'll open emails now, and then, you know, you can see by, like, December, they get totally not opened. But so in 2013, newsletter did a lot better than the 2014 newsletter. That was different in October. But if you see in the second semester, 2013, the orange did much better overall than the blue, which is the new, the 2014. So what we thought was a great improvement for design, and actually for faculty was a great improvement. We saw almost the opposite results with faculty. We found that people, that students weren't opening as much. It just didn't draw them in. And so we had to kind of step back and say, okay, do we need to go back to the old design, or do we have to figure out another way to draw people in? Because we're clearly not reaching as many people as we used to. We even dove down into some of the other metrics. I won't go into these today, but these are some of, this is again a screenshot from Google Analytics, page views, users, average session duration, and bounce rate. We'll be talking about those later in the semester when we get into the analytics section. So using that data to drive your decisions and drive action is really important because you can, for the first time in marketing, figure out what works because of the way that you can track it. All right, so the last thing I kind of want to talk about is this new, it's, I guess, a new way of thinking about marketing that really comes out of Silicon Valley and the tech world, the tech startup world. It's called growth hacking. And it was, the term growth hacker was coined by a guy named Andrew Chen, who's he's a great thought leader in sort of startup culture. He actually just recently went to head up marketing at Uber as the supply side. So he's like the head of marketing who's trying to get more drivers for Uber. Anyway, he is a great thinker, and he wrote this article that was called Growth Hacker is the New VP of Marketing. And he talked about, you know, okay, so what is a growth hacker? He defined it this way. A growth hacker is someone whose main job is to build great marketing into the product during the development process, not afterward, you know, not taking a finished product and figuring out how to market it, but building it into the product. He says the end goal of every growth hacker is to build a self-perpetuating marketing machine that reaches millions by itself. We'll talk some examples through so you guys can see what he's talking about. And then finally, it's somebody who uses customer acquisition techniques that you can test, track, or measure, and scale, right? So if you can get 10 new users to your site, can you scale that and get 100 using the same technique, 1,000, 1,000,000, right? So let's tell you guys, I want to tell you guys, give you a few examples of growth hacker case studies. Okay, so the first, Hotmail. If we take a step back in time to 1996, your parents were sending out really cute kid photos of you via Hotmail, right? I was at the top of my hair game because of Friends and Jennifer Aniston. All those layers looked amazing. So that's when Hotmail was introduced, 1996, right? It was the first free email available to people. And Hotmail, when they were developing, were thinking about how can we promote this service, right? And they were thinking traditional things like, oh, let's buy billboards, let's buy newspaper ads, but they just couldn't do it. They didn't have the money. They were a free product. So what they decided to do was to create this, a little bit of code that wrote this at the bottom of every email sent with Hotmail. P.S. I love you. Get your free email at Hotmail. So people who, I mean, I know it's hard to imagine, but like people who had never experienced email before were getting emails and they were like, this is amazing. How can I get this? And they made it very easy, right? So that's a great growth hack, just building it right in. They had a great product and building it right in there for people to get it. Another classic example, a little bit more modern times. How many of us have unfriended people on Facebook because of all of the game posts that they are trying to share with us, right? All of us. Like, it's our aunts. I don't know why our aunts are doing it more than anybody. But Farmville, which came from Zynga, the gaming company, they built into their games this social share so that if you shared on Facebook with just a one click, you could get more lives, or I don't even know what you get, but clearly you get some benefit because that's what they do. This was a great way for, we all know what Farmville is, even though most of us probably haven't played it, and that's because they built that sort of sharing right into the product. Dropbox is another great example. Dropbox is a great product, and you get a certain amount of storage for free. If you share with other people and recruit them, you get more storage. Groupon, you know, Groupon offers you great deals, but you can only get them if a certain amount of people buy them. So you, it's literally, you know, up to how much people share in the availability of the deal. And finally, Airbnb. This one's a little bit less obvious, but it's when Airbnb was started, and they were putting together the website and figuring out, okay, so here's where people will post their, you know, extra room or whatever it is, and then they'll put it out there. One of the coders said, wouldn't it be great if we could just with a click of a button have these people share it to Craigslist? And they were like, well, that would be great, but, you know, Craigslist doesn't have an open API, and but let's see if we can, like, hack a solution. So over a couple of days of coding, they were able to kind of hack a solution so that they had a button on the original listing that said post this to Craigslist. So marketers wouldn't necessarily, and what they talk about in the Growth Hacking article I mentioned, there's also a book by Ryan Holiday called Growth Hacker Marketing. They talk about how traditional marketers wouldn't have thought about that, and even if they did, it would have been a little bit too late. So they built that sort of sharing capability right into the product. So if you want to be a growth hacker, you know, it's not necessarily a set of skills that you have. It's more of a mindset. And here's what they talk about. The first thing is product market fit, basically building something that people want. And the way that you can figure out is if you have something that people want, or if you have a product that people want, is to build what's called the minimal viable product. So your product at the most basic level and figuring out if people actually use it. An example is Instagram. Instagram started out as a social check-in site called Bourbon, where it was much like Foursquare, where you would check in. And after they launched, they realized everybody loved this photo part of their app. And it was like the thing that people were using, and nobody was really checking in. They were only doing that so that they could use the photo sharing. So after a while, they said, okay, we know what people want. It's this photo sharing. Let's just get down to that basic, and that thus was born Instagram. And we know how well they've done. The second is having a growth mindset and having this mindset of trying to get attention. And this is a great idea, or a really great way to do this is to start with early adopters. Start with the people you know are going to like your product. Uber started giving away free rides at the South by Southwest conference. So Uber knew that most people, without having heard about it or having a friend who used it, wouldn't use their service, this ride-sharing service, but that tech people would be interested because they just were more open to that sort of innovation. So they started there at South by Southwest for 3 years. They gave away free rides. They offered food delivery. And that's really where they got their traction to become where they are today. The idea of virality, what is it that makes people want to share? How can you build that into the product? And how can you make it easy for people to share? So it has to be a good product, but then you can also try to make it easy for people to share with one click or just giving them an incentive that makes them want to do it. And finally, the idea of optimizing and retaining. So figuring out what works and repeating it. As an example, when Twitter first started as a business, and they were trying to get traction, they realized that their first problem was that people were interested in Twitter because they had gotten a ton of press, and they would sign up, and then they would never use it. And they realized that the people who would come back to use it were those who knew at least 5 other people on Twitter and connected with them right away. After they kind of measured this and realized it, what they did was then started suggesting to people, on the side of Twitter, here are people you might want to follow, and they made it very easy for people to follow, and sort of started helping facilitate those relationships that brought people back to Twitter. And then repeating that. There's in the tech world, and I saw this when I was working for Spill, and we were talking, we were fundraising, trying to raise money from tech investors. There's much more of a focus in the beginning on customer acquisition than there is on profitability. Like when we were fundraising for Spill, people didn't even care how we were going to make money. All they cared about was how we were going to get people to use our app or site. And that's really, for a lot of tech businesses, that's a truth. So when they are talking about optimization and retention, really, how do you optimize customer acquisition? How do you get people onto your site? And then how do you keep them there? And measure what works and then try to replicate that. Okay, so if we look holistically kind of at what we talked about today, what we're seeing in the digital marketing world, this is, you know, we talked about three changes, and we'll kind of look at what we see marketers who are doing it well doing kind of on the basis of that. So number one, consumers are in charge. And because of that, we now know that to be a good marketer, first you have to start by building something people want. You have to have product market fit. You want to start with your early adopters for growth, but also for really valuable feedback. So you can get feedback from them and maybe continually be iterating your product and optimize the product as you go on. The second idea, this idea that content is currency and can now buy attention. Because of that, we really see the best marketers adopting this publisher's ethos, understanding that they have to put out a lot of content to grab attention and keep it. And then also looking, measuring what content works and using that insight to drive their decisions and drive action. And then finally, this new idea of publicness or this new ethic of publicness. Businesses who are doing well are using this by building an integrated experience, knowing that people live publicly and will talk about their business, and so they want it to be a good experience on all of the platforms, as well as inspiring customers and building content that inspires them, and also building virality into their product and making it easy to share, knowing that people will do that if they do a good job of motivating them. So this is sort of a summary of the landscape of digital marketing today. Any questions, final questions, or thoughts? All right, great. I will see you guys on Wednesday, and don't forget to read the Big Skinny Case and post your thoughts online. I mean Monday. I never know what day it is. Monday. I'll see you next Wednesday, too, but Monday before that. Thank you. Oh, yeah, and you guys can leave your name tags on the table here. I'll keep them so you don't have to worry about bringing them back. Thank you for reminding me. Yeah, here is perfect. Thank you. I did. I haven't had a chance to get back to it. I'm just trying to think of some people. Excuse me for a second. I'm like recording my lectures for something. I just want to.